can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm Lisa Evans. I work at the Knowledge Foundation 4 days a week, working on the school data around spending stories. And I'm going to start with a bit of a history lesson, not that anyone needs it here, I imagine, which is in 2010, it was kind of open data boom time. Loads of spending data was released when the coalition was in power in May, and we were left with this kind of legacy where all the spending over certain thresholds was published as a monthly kind of monthly dump for all public bodies that receive money, and for central government bodies it was over 25,000, and for local government and health it was over £500. So that's what we've been receiving since 2010. And when we got that data, there was some of it was really structured and really nice, and so we could do kind of nice hierarchical diagrams, some of which you've probably seen. This is part of the Open Spending platform, which originally it was just to show UK spending, but now anyone in the world can upload their data to this platform, and if it's sufficiently structured, they can see it in a diagram like this, or, alternatively, like that. If it's less structured, then the way we've got around it is, well, the way we've initially handled it is to just show a big list of the data, and it's kind of unsorted form, so you can just search through it. So, 2013, all kinds of things have happened in the meantime. I think we're at a stage where these transparency activities are written into the proposals for government institutional change, which is a pretty big deal. So one example of this is in the abolition of the Audit Commission, where the Audit Commission used to regulate the audit in the UK for the NHS, local government and fire and rescue services. They did about 70% of that audit themselves. And they also did performance assessments and research activities into the economic value of local council activities. So, when the coalition came into power, one of the things that the local communities department wanted to do was to abolish the Audit Commission and outsource a lot of the audit to private companies. And it's not as quite as simple as that. I mean, the National Audit Office do get some control over kind of regulating that. But even so, in the consultation for the public consultation for this abolition, the one of the concerns and issues that they addressed was how will we maintain transparency when we don't have a publicly accountable body overseeing this audit. And they repeatedly mentioned in the consultation that there's this spending over £500, and so the public can hold the government to account, because we can see how what's going on with that. And later, when they gave their own response to the commission, to the consultation, they stated again that councils are encouraged to publish their data, and that they said that together these reforms have brought significant benefits to local bodies and local people. So I guess the big thing is, what can we actually work out from that spending? So the other factor that is kind of important in this is that there are huge, really significant spending cuts for the councils. So they're looking to reduce their spending by 26% between 2011 and 2015. And the National Audit Office did some analysis on this, and they found that as of this year, in the next 2 years, it looks like they're going to have to cut half of the spending because it hasn't been kind of slowly or front-loaded or any of that. So the real effects of the spending cuts are going to be coming in the next couple of years. And there's also an appetite, I think, in the press and to see kind of not just like a 26% cut, like what does it actually mean for people who are living in a certain area, like what are the end effects of the cuts? And that bit is really not clear, and I guess the only the place where people mostly point to that is in the spending over £500. So what can we do with their transaction data? I've seen lots of examples of showing total amounts by supplier, which is a great thing to do, but it has some problems. For example, you don't know exactly, like it requires further research once you've got that data. So you need to kind of know that spending, it might be a huge amount, but it may cover like a 10-year period or something. So just to show the suppliers ranked by the amount that they receive is kind of not the full picture, I think. So, but it's a good start. It's a really good start. And I was also wondering, can we see when a contract begins or when a contract ends from this data? This is particularly valuable for contracts that began before 2011, because now, of course, there's the contract finder, so like recent contracts you can trace more easily, but previous contracts and the things that are possibly going to be cut in the future may fall into this gap that you can only find through their spending over £500 for local councils and the NHS. So I did a project where I took Cambridge County Council and all their transaction data they published. And the first thing is to merge it because it's all in lots of files, one for each month, and often those files aren't in the same format, so you have to do a bit of kind of clever. Well, I wrote a Python script for it just to kind of automate it as much as possible, and then clean it. So I ran it through OpenRefine. Well, initially I just tried looking for patterns in it, and the patterns were really kind of dispersed. And I'll come on a bit more in the next slide to what I did. But when I did clean it and then I run the pattern, tried to look for the patterns again, they came through a lot more clearly. Like, by cleaning it, I mean, just looking for like grammatical errors or spacing or like kind of
dates look wrong.
Yeah, data that looks wrong. But I didn't go as far as saying, well, often the same company will will be listed a number of times, but it will be listed for a number of different regions, for example. And I didn't merge those, which I mean, I think might be interesting to do at some point, but because maybe they were different contracts. So I was being kind of tentative with it, I guess. But I looked for a few different patterns in it, and the first one was just looking for like repeat payments on the same day of a month. So if there was like if 50% of the payments are on the same date, what different months, then show me those. And that only resulted in like initially before I cleaned the data, only like 30, and then afterwards there was 90. So it's not huge returns on that. But the other thing that I did was I worked out the gaps in between the payments, and then I took the mean of those gaps. And then I took the standard deviation, so how much variation there is within from the mean of all the different gaps between payments. And if the standard deviation was low, so I had a cutoff point of like 2.5, just to get anything that's below there. And it pulled out like 900 different entries. So, and that was after I cleaned it up to this level. So it seems like the more you clean the data, and the more kind of, and that they're only like fairly simple tests of regularity in the payments. Like some of the payments will just be one-offs, and there's various reasons for that, and I count those as a separate kind of thing. My feeling is that I could merge these more aggressively, I should mention that all of the code and the data is available and to download. It's on the slide. If you want to have a look at it, we'll find some where suitable to put it at some point on the priority spending or spending stories somewhere. But at the moment, you can download it from the slides. Another thing is that the quality of the data is kind of, you can see it improving by the more you clean it in the confine, you can see it in the metrics. So that might be useful at some point when we come to do looking at other public bodies and seeing having an initial metric for how much work needs to be done on them to make them into something that's useful to the public. So I think I personally have mostly seen some sort of suppliers, but I'd be interested to see if you've seen really good use of transaction data. And because it's kind of written into government change that it's a useful thing. And I think beyond some of my suppliers, I've not really seen an awful lot with it. Or even case studies of where people have found a particular supplier and that's meant something to them. It's meant some kind of improvement in service or whatever. So, yeah. Any questions? And I could also order them by the total amount that they received as well. So it kind of narrows down things that might be of interest. The other thing that you can do with that is you can say, well, if there is some level of regularity, like, has that continued right until the last payment that could be made, like, that has been... So the last payment for Cambridge County Council was in November last year. Is there a really big gap between the last payment in that regular group and the last time they could have made a payment, had a payment recorded? If so, that looks like it might be a spending cut.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I should have been clear. So, yeah, it's just, I'm sure there's lots of other ways you could do it, and I'm really open to it.
Need you to move on, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
We're going to try some time. But there might be a bit of time at the end. Okay.
Right. So my name is Chris Taggart. I'm Two Friends Open Corporates, which I think quite a lot of you know. It's the largest open database of companies in the world, over 50 million companies now in 70 jurisdictions. We get huge amounts of data from by the open data communities who are scraping, but also we're increasingly being given data by governments. And for example, our World Bank is a client, and we're working with them. Lots of different intergovernmental and governmental bodies as well on this sort of stuff. What I really want to talk about today was corporate networks, which is what we're going to be releasing sometime in the next month. The problems with it and what we mean by corporate networks and what corporate networks are, how they work, how to understand them, where to get the data from. And I'm really just going to do this using a few sneak peeks of our data and of our functionality. This is still at an alpha stage, and so there are going to be things which are a little bit, sort of displays a little bit tricky, and also I'm rendering this on a VGA screen and doing complex network graphs. VGA is not really to be recommended. So anyway, so Open Corporates, it's a simple thing. It allows you to do things like search for something like Barclays anywhere in any of those jurisdictions, including in previous names. So we have Barclays Property Services, Barclays Incorporated, we have Barclays Bank, all sorts of other things which aren't related to it. Because the question is what do we mean by Barclays? And actually what most people in the who in the UK think of Barclays is actually the financial institution. If you're in Jersey, you might think of the Barclay Brothers. If you're in another country, which is it depends. And what we and that's actually one of the difficulties is that what we mean by something. What are we talking about when we're talking about networks? What are we talking about when we're talking about the parent company and things like that? It's actually quite tricky. And it's tricky, it's made more difficult by the fact that actually this stuff isn't generally published, or certainly it's not published in a consistent place in one place. Probably the best company register in the world is, particularly as far as open data goes, is New Zealand. They publish shareholding data for their companies. So if you go onto a company in New Zealand, you can see, and we can access through the API as data, you can actually see who the shareholders are. That company. They don't say what other, you can't do anything else other than see who the shareholders are, but you can see the shareholders. But if you put that together, you can actually do something like this. This is a public corporation in New Zealand, and all of this has been built by pulling this together. So we know that this is the parent of that because this company here has said that it's a shareholder. So you start to see a little bit more about what the company is really like. And this is a public company, so some of these are nominees. So if you own 100 shares in something, then you'll own to a nominee company. But actually this stuff here, in terms of what it owns and how it owns it, is pretty good. But this is actually a simplified version. This is a simplified version, it's actually twice simplified. simplified because the data underlying, there's a lot more data in terms of the dates it relates to and so on, and this is for the tree view, this is a simplified version, but also some of these companies will have other owners. So for example, if I've got the right thing, this is one of those companies, and you can see that Telecom Corporation, Telecom New Zealand owns this company, Sue Telecom New Zealand Limited, but it's also got other shareholders, including Vodafone. So when you do what's known as a forced directed graph view to see all the different things that we've got in this, with all the different links, this is what you get. And if I can zoom out a little bit. Okay. So you can already see that some of this is an incredibly complex world. And this is just from New Zealand shareholding this stuff. And this is not all New Zealand. We're still importing New Zealand. Every time, every couple of days, we've got about halfway through importing all of New Zealand, so in companies, we're about halfway through doing it. Every couple of days, I look at it, and it's actually, it grows a little bit deeper and a little bit more complex. So that's the sort of simple thing from a shareholding point of view. This is Barclays. This is Barclays Bank, the tree structure, and again, there's obviously difficulties when you've got it, because what we're talking about with these companies, when you think of a company, when you think about something like Microsoft, for example, you probably think it's a fairly straightforward company. It'll have subsidiaries based on divisions, subsidiaries based on geography, and may even have a few joint ventures, but it should be some sort of tree structure. And actually, it isn't. It's a much more complex structure. There'll be things to do with licensing between companies. There'll be all sorts of different aspects. This is Barclays Bank. This is Barclays Bank from two different sources. So if I do this this is to a very simple depth. I'll do this to a greater depth. And this is using a Wi-Fi on my phone, so it might take a few seconds to download this. As I said, this is live data that we've got in. So this is at a greater depth, at depth of 3. Now, it's a little bit difficult. Let's switch to the graph view to see if we can make a little bit more sense of it. And actually, this does help, it's also a little bit... but it helps me because I know a little bit more about it. Now, this stuff here comes from their SEC filing. All major companies that all public companies and companies listed on the US stock markets and a few other things as well have to report at the SEC, and they report their subsidiaries, their significant subsidiaries, and so they'll report this. But actually, they will report this, it's in raw text. It's in and there are loads of different formats, and it changes from year to year, from company to company. It's almost entirely random. So we're doing this parsing out of this, and we're getting these hundreds of companies there. This stuff is actually from the Federal Reserve's own bank hierarchy database. They maintain a bank hierarchy database, and this comes from it. Now, actually, probably some of these maybe actually also exist further out on this stretch. But this is where it starts to get interesting. Because, I was thinking about this as Lisa was talking, the point about the Audit Commission is twofold. Is the Audit Commission is there, what was there, and I was a huge critic of the Audit Commission, was there to make sure that things happened, even if there weren't a group of well-educated people with time on their hands to be able to do this sort of stuff. But the second is that things like Audit Commission have statutory powers. Now, sometimes statutory powers are actually not massively helpful because you just focus on those. So this top stuff is published for the public. This bottom stuff is in theory published for the public, but the data is, it took us about a week to scrape this. Now, we will probably be the only organisation in the country that has this in the world, sorry, that has this as data like this. But it was really difficult. But there's actually errors in that data there. So we were looking at this stuff. And so I think one of the questions is just this balance between the benefits that being outside the loop sometimes can bring, and also inside. And I think one of the things that ultimately we have to, as a society, move to is allow that connecting of the outside and the inside together. Sometimes things need statutory powers to investigate. I mean, I've been involved in a number of audits, and the point is that as an auditor, an auditor can say, I want this piece of information, tell me what the story is behind this, so on, and actually they can go down several routes. Now, you can do some of that with FOI, but actually there are statutory powers that auditors have to do all sorts of things. So when you look at some of this, this by the way is Morgan Stanley, so Morgan Stanley, this is only to a depth of 3. If we did this to a depth of say 50, then it would show a lot more. So Morgan Stanley in its graph on the FDIC has got about 8,000 different entities in it. If I show you, this is one that's one of those ones that's in the loop, Ember Investments LLP, which is a UK company which we've now matched as having matched to a company, and we've matched to the SEC says it's filing on the SEC says its parent is Barclays PLC. But you know what? That doesn't exist in the FDIC's data. So what you've got there is actually we've got better data than the Federal Reserve, and not only have we got better data than the Federal Reserve in some respects, we've also started to find mistakes. So there was one company here which I'm going to just this company here is on their data. This is where we got the data from. Quadros Investments Too Limited, Luxembourg. In Luxembourg. Okay. Now we were trying to find match this, and because we thought, well, we've got Luxembourg companies, we should be able to match that. Probably it's a bug in our, our matching isn't as good as it should be. But actually, it turns out that it isn't that this data is wrong, and we've been speaking with the Federal Reserve, and we know people there about this, and they're looking into why it's wrong, because it turns out it's this company. Or rather, this is the entry that we've got that closest matches it, which is a UK branch of a Cayman Islands company. A couple of interesting things here. We did it because actually we started looking for Claudus Investments Too Limited. So they've got the name, they've got the typo in the name, they've got a typo in the jurisdiction, and they've actually got the jurisdiction wrong. The other thing is, even though it's a Cayman Islands company, and it's notoriously difficult to find information about Cayman Islands companies, we've got all of these directors. And we can look at these directors and see, for example, what other companies they're directors of. Tony Hurst has done some great mappings of this sort of stuff. So what we've got here is a really complex world where there's bits of public data here and there. Again, this is International Business Regimes. This is this main one is from the SEC filings. The one on the right is actually subsidiaries that so far have been reported that we found in the New Zealand company register based on that. So again, this is actually a subset of what the real data is. And I think that this is a real opportunity for the open data community and for the wider community. Again, like with things like what we've seen with Wikipedia, what we can do is by tying all these disparate sources of data together, by having to a certain extent curated by the community and having intelligence added by the community, I've got an idea what that means, then we can actually do something that's really cool. I just want to end with this. This is Facebook. This is what they own in the world, according to their SEC filing. Now, my guess is that's not actually what they own. And in fact, we pretty much know that that's not what it owns. Sorry, I'm going to go if I can find the right thing. Because here we've got Facebook New Zealand Limited, which is owned by Facebook Global Holdings 2 LLC, which is a Delaware company, I think. Neither of those are actually on that list of subsidiaries. So one of the things that we're doing at the moment is we're building a crowdsourcing platform, which we should be launching in about 6 weeks or so. If you want to email info@opencorporates.com if you want to have a play with it. But the quote is here we've got this little graph here, just of two things. How do we connect that graph to the rest of it? How do we connect all those other companies called Facebook? And if I just do, and then I'm done. All all those other companies called Facebook, how do we connect those into the graph as well? It's a bit like Ancestry.com or Genie or something like that. You've got a graph here of somebody's family tree, a graph here of someone else's family tree. How do we connect those together? Actually, I think we're doing it's working pretty well. The people who have seen this, that have been involved in proprietary solutions, say that that actually what we're doing is something that's pretty exciting and pretty scary from their perspective. It's all going to be available as open data. This is just an example of how we pull this together, where we got it from, what the problem is, what our confidence is, and so on. So, yeah, that's it. Thank you. So the SEC filings are, the question is, are the SEC filings wrong? We sent a file to the SEC commissioner about 2 weeks ago. The problem is that they report significant subsidiaries, and significant subsidiaries means ones that are in themselves material. The difficulty is if so with Google, for example, Google used to list something like 100 and something subsidiaries. 2009. Now they list two, both in the Highlands, because everything else that is material is underneath those two. They're all just wrapped up in that, and then they just report those two. Now, the problem with that is, there's nothing to stop them reporting a lot more than that, but they think, well, why should we? Why do we want anyone to, we're the most powerful company in the world, why would we want anyone to see what we're doing? Because someone might be able to compete against us, for example, or someone might be able to understand that we're not doing this, or we're doing this, or that we do this. So so essentially it's the rules that are broken. The fact that it's one of the things that allows those broken rules to exist without people making a fuss is that the data is, that it's basically type that you're seeing there, and that does that. So they're not, as in so many things, they're not breaking they're following the rules, but they're gaming the rules. I've said this before in other presentations, but the most successful hackers in the world are corporate lawyers. They do it without any, they have huge resources, they get really well paid for it, and they never go to jail. And they are great at taking sets of rules, which is what I think of hacking is, taking sets of rules in different places, in different countries, and finding the gaps between those rules. And that's what's happening there.
Can you say anything about your roadmap for this? It's obviously going to be interesting to the public, for accountability, to be interested in corporates and auditors for all that information.
Absolutely. So what we're doing at the moment, we've been concentrating up to now on collecting the data, finding sources of data. We've got three main sources of data at the moment, which is the New Zealand Company Register, the SEC, and the Federal Reserve. We've got about another dozen or so sources of data that we can use. We're hoping that the UK Companies House are going to be opening up the shareholder data that they have, and they do have some actual data as about shareholdings. And then what we're doing, so just one of the other things, there's a couple of, one of the things that we're quite keen on is actually showing the data with ambiguities, with conflicts. So this for example is a real estate investment trust in a state, and I'll just try to see if I can move it around, which might not be possible. These companies here. These companies here in their SEC filing. This company says it owns these companies, but also that company says in its companies it says it's SEC filings. One of the things that the proprietary solutions are very bad at, they don't give any provenance because they don't want to tell you where the data came from, and they don't want you to admit that it's all being modelled based on names of things, which is a really bad way of doing it. We'd rather say, okay, look, there's a conflict here. There's something that doesn't seem to make sense. It might be to do with time. It might make sense in some sense, but not in others. So what we've been doing is doing the collecting the data, and we'll be showing our first guess at it, and then refining it. What we've already done is we've already found some interesting things, you know. So what can this mean? Well, okay. So there are companies that we found, which I might be able to find here, that are circular. So company A owns company B. Company B owns part of company A. We're storing all of this in a graph database, and that's how we found those sorts of companies. So it allows you to do those sorts of, oh, let me look for those patterns. This thing, is this potential, is this a warning sign? Can we produce queries that are warning signs and so on? So, you know, and the other thing that's, it is, you know, for people like tax officers and so on, there's obvious potential here for that sort of stuff as well. And we're talking with them. So, I've got to stop. Okay.
Hi, my name's John Sheridan. I work at the National Archives. I'm a civil servant, and I'm responsible for the team who runs a thing called legislation.gov.uk. And Chris is just opening up some slides, which I'm going to try and rattle through really quickly. So, idea number one is legislation is difficult. And I'm going to illustrate this to you by looking at a little bit of the UK's statute. So this is a piece of legislation called the Academies Act. It was passed in 2010. It was one of the first pieces of legislation passed after the election in 2010. And it puts in place the provisions for companies who are going to be running academies. And in particular, in section 12, in subsection 4, it amends the Charities Act. So it says, basically, if you are a company running an academy, for the purposes of doing that, you can be treated as a charity. That's what this piece of legislation is doing. Okay. So section 12, subsection 4, amends the Charities Act. If you then go and look later on in this piece of legislation, you find there's this thing called commencement. And commencement basically is telling you when bits of the legislation get turned on, when it comes into force. So here at commencement, this is section 19, it says, sections 15 to 20 come into force immediately when the Act is passed. Now, when the Act was passed, they knew the day it was passed. But it says, on the day the Act is passed, you need to know to go look just under the long title it has in square brackets the day the Act was passed. But what about section 12? Well, section 12 isn't referenced in commencement, so we don't know when it's come into force. But then you look a bit further on, it says, well, the timing of this will happen on some day where the Secretary of State, a minister, will decide. So then you go find another piece of legislation, which is the Secretary of State making an order called a commencement order, bringing the first thing into force. And you can see on the 1st of January 2011, section 12, subsection 4 of the Academies Act came into force, thereby amending the Charities Act 1993. And if you happen to be a company and you're looking to run an academy, that's when you get to be treated like a charity. So it's something that matters to you in those circumstances. Now, the point is that this is really typical. This is how the statute book works as a system. You get these patterns where A changes B when C says so. So one thing creates a power for somebody to then make another piece of legislation that will then turn on or off something that something else has done. So these patterns of one piece of legislation interacting with another is very complex and very typical. This is essentially how the statute book works. If you start to graph what this looks like, you end up with the proportion of the statute book that you need to know about in order to know the current in force state of one act. This is the Company Audit and Investigation Act 2004. Right, is massive. So the statute book is pretty complex. It changes over time. It's better than that. So I'd like to introduce you to the Interpretation Act 1978, which is like a machine. And it does little things in the statute book. It does jobs. So one of the jobs it does is it says, in any piece of legislation, when you say a person, it also means a company, unless it says otherwise. And when it says, land, it means land that may be covered by water, unless it says otherwise. And also here, it's doing the job, which is if one piece of legislation repeals something, and then that gets repealed, the Interpretation Act stops the original thing leaping back into life. Similarly, if Parliament replaces a piece of common law, which has just been done with the Defamation Act, law around defamation and libel has been managed under the common law principally for a very long period of time, and Parliament decided to try and clarify the law by passing the Defamation Act, moving some provisions from common law into statute law. Now, if that act got repealed, to stop the common law springing back into life again, it's the Interpretation Act. The thing is, it only applies to legislation from the 1st of January 1979. So you need to look at a 19th century Interpretation Act if you're looking at the meaning of the words for legislation before the 1st of January 1979 compared to after the 1st of January 1979. So here's the rub, right? When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said, in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The question is, said Alice, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, says Humpty Dumpty, which is to be the master? That's all. The courts will, on occasion, use it to understand the meaning of the words that are contained in legislation, particularly for older statutes. Also, our tradition has changed. In the 19th century, legislation was interpreted simply on the words that were used in the legislation passed by Parliament. We now have moved to a purposeful tradition where the courts will interpret not just the words that are in the Act, but the courts will also look at what Parliament's intent and purpose was in terms of trying to understand what the state of the law is. That means that we've moved from a place where Hansard, as a record of Parliament, looking at Hansard was not something that the courts would do when they were trying to work out what the state of the law was or what Parliament was aiming to do, and now that's a legitimate thing for the courts to do. So this very interesting kind of intersection around language and different sources of information. The key point I want to leave you with is that fundamentally this is an information problem, that the statute book is a complex system, and in order to be able to understand it properly, you need not just to know what the current state of the text is, but you need to start to connect that text with other sources of information, crucially, resources like Hansard, resources like court judgments, dictionaries even. So how do we move to a place where you can do that systematically, easily? It's a work of a lifetime, really, in many senses. But it means, and this is kind of how users of legislation feel about it in many cases, it's hard. It means thinking about legislation as data. And this, we are entering an era where some of these problems, which have been around forever, have become tractable. And they're tractable in the sense of, if we can create systems and processes whereby we can gather the kind of intelligence, editorial information that we need in order to be able to provide contextually the right information that allows you to understand when you're reading a section of the statute book which piece of interpretation legislation applies, whether there's any particular terms that you should know about, or whether there's some relevant references elsewhere. These are the sorts of applications that thinking about the statute book as data and connecting it to other related data can deliver for us, enable for us. But the statute book also defines many other things. Chris is talking about companies. Where does our notion of a company come from? It comes from legislation. We think about statutes too often like this, these kind of rolls of texts that Parliament has made over 800 and something odd years. We need to understand it more in terms of this kind of interconnected wheels and diagrams, wheels of words, projecting down the conceptual structure that we live in. This is the mental model that we need to have of this system. So it becomes a really interesting question. how do we start to take some of these concepts that are defined in documents and turn them into reusable data in a way in which we can start to gather and collect the information that we need in order to be able not just to understand the state of the law, but potentially to better comply with it. So when you put data goggles on, you start looking at the statute book, you begin to see data in all sorts of places, definitions, changes to legislation, which we're looking at earlier, when duties and powers are conferred, and the relationship between duties and powers, offences, transposition. So where in legislation are laws being made in directives in Europe that have been transposed into UK domestic law, and designations of things. And then there's lots and lots of data about legislation. The point I want to stress to you is that it's really important to see the statute book not just as a set of documents, but as a set of data. And in order to be able to work with or interpret this complex system, thinking about it from the perspective of data, and crucially open data that we can connect and link together, is a really important activity. What would it be if we could just start to plug things into the statute book question? Now, the second thing is, I also want to talk a little bit about the concept of legislation as code. So if I can convince you of two things, well, maybe three. One, that legislation is complicated. Two, that we need to be thinking about legislation as data. And three, that we are already thinking about legislation as code. Why does this matter? Well, it matters because self-driving cars are legal in three states in the United States. We have entered an era where the robots are starting to become amongst us. And they need to comply and obey with laws. That's part of it. But another part of it is that in terms of how government complies with the law itself, it can find itself in situations where it makes a lot of sense to make legislation more machine processable. So what we start to see is the use of things like Oracle's policy automation. And this is from the Oracle website. And this patented technology, Open Folk Note, patented technology that provides a powerful platform to transform complex legislation, regulations, and policy documentation into executable software. Now, if you're a government and you want to pass some legislation and you want to build a system that operates some process in a way that allows you to demonstrate that you're complying with the legislation that you have passed such that you can mitigate your risk of legal challenge, for example, that you're giving people money or you're allowing them in or out of the country, this is great technology to use. So where do we start to see this? If you look at something like the Universal Credit Regulations 2013, the UK's implementation has been heavily influenced by, and may only be possible, in fact, by the use of Oracle's policy automation technology. You can see the telltale signs of OPA in the face of the statute book when you see sections, this would be Regulation 71, Step 1, indentation. Step 2, indentation. Step 3, and then Step 4. And at the bottom it says deduct 110. This is a piece of legislation that is wearing its OPA origin in its structure and its layout. This is this was written to be to have a very short step into being turned into a machine processable form. Legislation is becoming code very rapidly around us. Where's the open source alternatives? They're very immature. Here's one project I could find on GitHub, which is called Hamurabi, I think. But the open community is not paying sufficient attention to some of these things. Why does this matter? It matters because the rule of law can be wiped out in one misguided, however well-intentioned, generation. If we're going to have computers that process laws directly, I would really like to see how those computers work. I would really like to have multiple implementations of the software that directly processes the law that governs me. And I would like policymakers and parliaments to be able to, and courts and judges to be able to test how those machines are working too. So legislation is complex, it's data, we can use data to understand that complexity. It is also becoming code. These are profound questions from the perspective of the rule of law. These things are happening around us, we need to pay attention to them, and we need to think hard about how in this era we protect the basic principles of the rule of law.